welcome to the 440 Guitar Podcast. I am your host, Jarrell Powell. Thank you so much for tuning up. You can catch the podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and anchor.fm/440. Be sure to follow the podcast on Instagram as well, at the 440 Guitar Podcast, to get updates on the episodes coming out. And also, if you had a question, if you knew of an artist that you think I should speak to, or anything, or all the above, you can either send me a direct message on Instagram, email me at the440podcast@gmail.com, or you can leave me a voicemail at anchor.fm/440. I've gotten in touch with an artist that way as well, so feel free to do that if you'd like to do so. And today I'm very excited to speak with this artist that I came across the algorithms, that is YouTube. But he is a very accomplished session player. He's traveled all around the world, and he has a pretty substantial fan base on YouTube. I mean, I've seen videos from 200, 300 plus thousand views on some of his videos, and happy and humbled to have him on the show. The 440 Guitar Podcast is excited to have Anthony Mutharaja. I almost had it, man. Mutharaja?
Yeah, that's it.
Okay. People pronounce my name all the time. I mispronounce my name all the time. And I'm like, it's Jarrell. It's not that hard, but. Right. So I can only imagine on your end. I'm like, it's not that hard.
Yeah, I mean, it's not too bad, though. This was a little bit of a slipper, but you got it. Because most people tend to have a harder time. Yeah.
So let me try this again. Anthony Mutharaja.
Yeah. That works.
How are you doing, sir?
I'm good, man. How are you?
I'm good. I appreciate you speaking with me today. It seems like it's getting that time of the year where it's getting colder and colder. I know you're in. Are you in New York City now?
Yeah, I just moved here. Yeah.
Oh wow, wow! So I can only imagine the weather change up. Is it it's something that you've got that you're used to? I know you travel. You know you've traveled pretty significantly throughout your time.
It's I wouldn't say. I'm used to it in the sense of living, but I've experienced colder temperatures, probably similar to New York in my travel. So I don't have much of a problem, but of course living through it is a different experience because it's day in and day out, right? Because
right.
Otherwise you're just in and out, but this one's like, okay, that's every day. But I'd still take this though, because I grew up with a lot of heat. I grew up in intense summers. So I think the cold is a welcome change I'll happily take.
Okay. Yeah, it's a good trade-off, right?
Yeah.
Very cool. Very cool. So the 440 Guitar Podcast, we're really big on origin stories, how people got to where they are today. And first question, usually I tend to ask all my artists here on the show, tell me about your earliest memories of music.
Earliest memories of music, like from a playing standpoint, was when I was 12. That's when I first started to actually play. But my most vivid memory of really being captivated by music was probably when I was 3 or 4, watching the drummer at church play, you know, so it really got to me. And funny enough, as an 11-year-old or 12-year-old, I got my first guitar, learned a bunch of chords, you know, and I was like, oh, I could probably play like acoustic guitar in the church band, you know, for service. But on the parallel, I was already playing quite a bit of drums. So I ended up joining the worship team as a drummer. So I played a lot of drums and the guitar came much later. But yeah, that's the earliest memory, like when I was 12 and started playing drums in church, and eventually I started playing the guitar. Yeah.
Wow. So so church was kind of, as far as just music in general, that was kind of one of the first I guess exposures to music was in the church.
Yeah, the first exposure to live music was definitely in the church, because growing up where I grew up, so I grew up in Bahrain, which is a tiny little island country in the Middle East. So at the time, the population of the entire country was less than 500,000. So it's a very small place, right? So we didn't really have a lot going in terms of live music. So the only form of music you could actually watch live was in churches, basically. So that's what I got exposed to from that angle. And then eventually, yes, I did start getting into other styles of music. But from a live experience, yes, it was the church that I was first exposed to.
Interesting. Wow. And then as far as, so when it, because I know you said one of the first things that caught your eye was the rhythm section as far as for drums and whatnot, which I think is interesting too, because I hear a lot of people, musicians, you know, they say, you know, when you're a drummer starting out, before you get to guitar, it can definitely improve your guitar playing, probably just because you already had that concept of rhythm, you know, and being able to keep on time. So I hear that definitely kind of helps that process. Did it help when you were learning, when you switched to guitar and whatnot?
Yeah. So I think I like to believe all of us, no matter what state of learning an instrument we are at, I think we all have a sense of rhythm.
Yeah.
You know, let's just say, assume that. I think what tends to happen is that when we pick up an instrument, it's hard to contextualize the rhythm. So when I started playing with drums, I was also in parallel playing the guitar a little bit already. So I had the sense of rhythm kind of translating, but you take aside, like say comping or playing rhythm guitar, let's say lead guitar, that's a little different because in that context, you're thinking more melodies and rhythm behind melodies is quite different too. So it's like different train of thought, but I think there are pluses and minuses for starting with drums and then moving onto the guitar or the bass or whatever it is. Mm. Yeah.
Tell me about those negatives, because I think that's interesting as far as just the advantages, disadvantages, besides the fact that, you know, you're not starting with that instrument first, right?
Right. Okay. The primary advantage is that you not only have a good sense of rhythm, but a good sense of how a groove should feel, right? Because one thing is playing the right notes and the right rhythm, but playing everything with the feel is the most appropriate thing we can try to do. So that's the primary advantage. Besides that, of course, your ability to support in a band is different. Because you take away the drums and bass, typically that's what we rely on to carry a groove.
Right.
But I think playing drums and then playing something else, naturally you have more of a groove in you than you would, like, let's say if you started with the guitar, right?
Yeah.
So those are the primary advantages. I think the disadvantage is that while you might have a very strong sense of groove and rhythm, it is hard to justify, let me try to put this as clearly as I can. It's hard to justify the note choices or the way you combine notes on the guitar purely because your rhythm is good. So for instance, rhythm is everything, yes, but you kind of need a certain, like, you know, certain chords sound a certain way when you arrange them according to the way they are laid out, the notes. But if you don't have those things in place, but you have rhythm, you know, because of playing drums, you kind of start to negate the importance of that, like actually studying chords and actually knowing what this note does against that chord, you know? So I think a rhythmic approach is great, but it cannot be isolated. So that's actually, it's funny because a lot of my favorite drummers that I grew up listening to and I admire till date, almost all of them play a second instrument, either guitar or piano. And they always try to draw the same parallels. Like they try to cross relate whatever they relate from drumming to the guitar. They try to throw it back from the guitar. What can I take back to the drums? So again, that is actually an advantage, but it can easily become a disadvantage if you don't manage it well. So I think those are my primary takeaways in terms of pros and cons of,
That makes a lot of sense too, because it's like there's a whole system of music, you know what I mean? So like it can be, at times it could be potentially overwhelming. Yep. You know, for a drummer, because I have a friend who's a really good drummer, but I think him going into other instruments, I think it's a little overwhelming, I think, for him in some ways, you know. So I think if you're not kind of starting around, you know, learning at least one, you know, instrument that is, you know, not rhythmic and, you know, obviously a system that you have to learn, definitely I can see that being a most definitely a disadvantage. Tell me about So obviously you told me that, you know, in the church, that's kind of when the sonic stuff started to happen for you as far as learning these instruments. Were there any, like, this is one of the obvious, one of the old questions, but just a question that I love asking. I mean, who are your kind of guitar heroes in a sense, or, you know, your musicians that were, you know, motivators to you as you were learning?
Right. So I, one of the primary influences from a guitar standpoint for me was Stevie Ray Vaughan, right? SRV. So it was funny and frustrating because I loved, and I still love SRV to date, just everything about the sound, the feel. But I could never play it. I could never get close to it, right? At the time, of course, I couldn't relate to the blues in that sense because I think the blues is a very interesting style of music because it's so simple, yet it is so difficult to get it right. Because again, it's that feel thing, right? So, and then it makes a lot of sense because blues is usually typically backed up with a lot of pain and baggage. You know, it's got so much emotional weight in that sense. So from a learning perspective, I was heavily into the blues, but like I said, I couldn't get it right. I couldn't play it well. So I went to the next best heavy thing. So I started listening to more like heavier rock and metal music, which is quite a deviation from like gospel, right? So it's like it's quite on the opposite spectrum in that sense. So once I got into heavy metal, I was like listening to like a lot of Metallica, Led Zeppelin, and then simultaneously, I started checking out like Joe Satriani, Steve Vai, and a few others. But eventually, what's funny is I went to college, music college for a bit as a guitar player. But my interests in music and the guitar completely flipped because I started playing the bass. And then I was just like, I was pretty confused at the time, but now I'm glad I made the switch. So I was just like, you know what? I want to probably play bass more. So I switched my major, my primary instrument to bass, but I still listen to a lot of guitar players. So I think if I had to narrow it down, my early stages of guitar playing, definitely Joe Satriani, Yngwie Malmsteen, like the rock blues and shreddy guys from then. But as the years went on by, I started getting more into like jazz and jazz fusion. So some names would be like Pat Martino, Jim Hall, Wes Montgomery, of course. I had a phase of John McLaughlin as well. But if I had to culminate everything into one person, I think for me it is Alan Holdsworth. That when the first time I listened to Alan, it was shape-shifting in every way imaginable, not just from guitar playing, but just the sounds he was getting out of it and the chords, the way it was like a wall of sound, which is so unlike, like, let's say heavy metal or any form of music which is rather heavy sounding. It sounds big and it really comes at you, but Holdsworth's music for me, I felt like it was coming at me real strong, but it was still very mellow to digest. So for me, yeah, for sure, he definitely has the longest lasting influence on my music overall, not just the way I approach the guitar, but the way I see and hear things. He definitely plays the biggest role out of the names I mentioned.
Interesting. I wonder if it's because of, you know, his. I feel like a lot of his note choices, you know, as far as him, even him, like creating these names of scales that they may or may not be accurate, you know, but like these certain patterns, and then just him being able to stretch and have these crazy, you know, intervals within these scales, you know, that just, you know, it's funny because I feel like when it. You know, when we talk about fusion, you know, at least in my brain, you know, I feel like you have to kind of mention Alan Holdsworth. I feel like he's kind of one of the early adopters, at least for me anyway, just from my age. But it's just like when you're hearing something that mixes in, but then it gives you this tension, you know, such an interesting tension there.
Because I think what I admire the most about him is that when you listen to fusion, I mean, of course, another name I forgot to mention is Frank Gambale. I mean, he's just an animal. And then of course you have Aldi Miola. There's a lot of these guys. But with Alan, I felt like it's like what you said, the no choices thing. Like, in fact, in him coming up with these weird names and just weird trains of thought to justify certain things he was doing, I think that's what I liked about it. Cause the fact that he was not conformed to a particular shape or sound or rule book. He just kind of broke it and said, nah, when I play solos, I don't want to sound like I'm picking my notes.
Right.
Which is like pretty interesting in that sense, you know? So
yeah,
I think, and that's a very important part of how I felt influenced was that, music aside, the way I think as a person even, just it just affected me drastically because it's like, hey, you know what? You just cannot give a shit about anything or anyone. Just kind of find what works with you and resonates with you and then give it a shot. Give it all you got, you know? So it's that kind of a mentality that got instilled in me thanks to him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's interesting too, like when it comes to, because obviously today there's a lot more reference material and understanding and learning his music. I know there's one guy that he has like a 5-hour YouTube video.
Yes.
Dissecting all of his stuff. I'm like, wow, what a time to be alive. I thought he brought up a really good point. I feel bad that I forgot his name, but he makes a really great point as far as like how bad of a teacher Alan Holdsworth is, because he had these instructional videos that like he would play things, but describing it, what he was playing, it wasn't necessarily the most, you know, fluid to understand. When did you decide that you wanted to be, to be a teacher in music? When was that?
So when I was in college and I made the whole transition to playing bass, I had a great teacher back in college who was a mentor for me in life and music. So he always was sure to make me think about certain things a lot before I actually sit to practice or do anything. And one of the things he always told me is that, you know, however you understand and whatever you're able to understand, you also must be able to explain yourself. So basically, to be able to not just justify, but also clarify the choices you make. And I was like, okay.
Great point.
You know, as an 18-year-old, when you hear that, you're like, yeah, whatever. but
Pentatonic.
Yeah. I'm like, yeah, whatever, old man. Like, I'm just going to shred. I'm just going to do whatever I want. But over time, then I started listening to music, right? So as a bass player, I was, of course, Jaco was the guy I went to. But
yeah,
when I started listening to music from that angle, I started paying attention to the intention of why we play or why do we choose that over this. So I think in the process of digesting or understanding certain concepts and material over time, I also started making notes of certain concepts and really simplifying it as best as I can. Because if there's one thing I'm not a big fan of is overcomplicating something that doesn't need to be complicated in the first place. Right? Because, I mean, it's simple. You could, like, you take 10 guitar players, throw them into a room and just start talking about bending, for instance, which is a very nice technique to have. But I'm sure you can get 5 or 10 hours of conversation out of just bending. Now, that can be good. But in my opinion, it's like bending is bending. It's a device. And we understand that. We have different parameters. I can bend up a whole step or a step and a half and maybe just a half step, you know, and then you kind of review the information and go, okay, you know, that's about it from a very fundamental standpoint. So I basically started noticing that I was able to break down complicated concepts to a very simple setup, you know, wherein, like, let's say it's something like what Alan was trying to do. So Alan's train of thought is so complicated only because I think is just how he is, much like Jacob Collier.
Right.
Because Jacob Collier has got his whole thing with how he hears chords and polarity. Now, you mentioned that to a musician, like, all, like 9 out of 10, we would be like, what do you mean by polarity? What do you mean by negative harmony or polar opposite chords? Like, you know, like when these words get thrown out, it's like, it sounds really cool, but in the long run, I think it can be detrimental if a student or somebody who wants to study music chooses to focus on those components, right?
Mm.
So I very indirectly and unknowingly developed a passion to share. And I definitely am not hesitant to share anything to the very smallest details that I have done in terms of practice to get to where I am. So yeah, I think it was just that whatever I absorb, I have the need or the urge to want to share it, because I feel like that's the least we can, all of us can do.
Yeah.
And the beautiful part is it's as long as we kind of stay true to ourselves as people, I feel like me and you could sit down with the same thing, but we will sound different. Whether
right.
whether or not we like it, it's bound to happen, because you're Jarrell, I'm Anthony. We have certain things about us fundamentally which will not change. So no matter what the concept, something in us would make us do it differently.
Yeah.
Which is what gives me the confidence to just teach all the secrets, you know?
Right. It's an interesting point you make, because I feel like throughout time, you know, I feel like there's been these like informational gatekeepers where it's like, no, I don't want to share, you know, I don't want to share how I do this thing. I worked hard at this. But then, you know, I remember I had a Pritesh Walia on the show, and it was like, he basically said what you said. He's like, you'll never sound like me because I play like me. He's like, why not share this knowledge with people so they can, you know, they can learn it, you know? And now you got all these videos where it's like, oh, how to play jazz easy, you know? Or it's like, you talk to John Coltrane or Charlie Parker or Miles Davis. It's like, what the fuck are you talking about, you know?
yeah. It's everything is, it's that, you know? So, so basically, like as a bass player, like I started seeing a lot of these bass channels, and there's plenty of good ones, but there's plenty of shitty ones too. So I was just like, you know what, I want to cater to a specific crowd. I actually want to cater to people who are either working musicians or very serious music enthusiasts, right? Because I feel like I don't need to show anybody how to play scales and position. That's granted.
Right.
But I was like, how about you learn to play it one string at a time? Let's see how that gains traction.
Mm.
And before you know it, there was like a bunch of guys who were just like, man, I never thought of approaching it that way.
Mm.
And funny enough, that is something I directly borrowed from the guitar world, when as a rock guy or as a rock blues guy, I remember watching an old video of Joe Satriani where he talks about modes, but he plays all the modes on just the E string. And I thought that was interesting, where he just used one string to kind of go through it all. And I was just like, oh, you could actually do that in theory on every string, right? But I didn't think of it at the time. I just did it all in the E and I kind of wrapped it up. I was done. I didn't look at the other five strings. So yeah, basically, I think it's like what you said, the gatekeepers of information, like that. I mean, there's only one reason why people would be gatekeepers of information, is because they want you coming back for more, which
right.
I think it's fair from a content creation standpoint, but from a standpoint of, let's say, if you look at this as a form of service, you know, where you're sharing, I think it's not nice. Because if you're able to talk about something in 10 minutes, but you want to stretch it across 10 hours and you sell it and package it as a 3-part course, it's like, I get why you do it economically and financially, but, you know, let's find the middle ground for this, which is why, like, on my channel, I don't withhold information, but of course I do try to keep it within the limit of, in terms of time,
sure.
Because whatever said and done, I earn through music as a teacher and as a performer. So I have to take care of certain needs, but otherwise I'm just very straight up and honest about a lot of the things I feel and share. Yeah.
Talk to me about your philosophy around scales, because I feel like there's always this ongoing controversy when it comes to it. I know in general, I've seen a few videos where you explain certain scales. I feel like as far as just to understand, you know, how there can be a certain dissonance or different, you know, different sonic sounds that can kind of create a different articulation or texture. But then you have a lot of guys, you know, you have a lot of people in the YouTube comments where it's like, don't think of scales, man. The masters, they thought of chord tones and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, how do you know what they thought? You know, like, I guess my question to you is what is the, to why do you approach some of your videos in general from a scale perspective? Is it more so just because it's something that's familiar to a musician?
I think from a very basic point of view, right? Mm-hmm. So you take any instrument, the first thing you're going to try to do or possibly pay somebody to teach you is build your technique.
Yeah.
Once your technique starts getting somewhere, you start learning chords and then scales, or sometimes scales and chords depending on the instrument. Mm. However, those chords are usually just triads. They're just 1, 3, 5.
Right.
Chords that, you know, like I always do this with a lot of guitar players. Like imagine we're on an R&B gig and I just stop the guitar player and say, hey, can you just play triads? More than likely, they're not going to, because first of all, it might not sound, not only would it not sound appropriate, but you get so used to playing something a certain way that when I tell you to stop, it fights you. And then before you know, you're not able to execute. So the reason why I approach things from a scale point of view is because chords come from scales.
Right.
So it's like, you know, it's like a chicken and egg situation. Mm-hmm. We both of it is important, but if you had to ask me, like, I guess the chicken came first. So for me, in that regard, scales came first. Yeah. I think thousands and thousands of years ago, the first people who were trying to make music were singing rhythms and melodies. Nobody was singing chord tones. Nobody was nobody was singing like quartet harmonies, which, I mean, not that it makes it bad. It's beautiful music, but the priority was rhythm and melody. So melody is what anybody can actually relate to. You know, if I just pull out somebody from the street and sing a melody, they'd be able to sing it back to me. But if I sing an arpeggio with a 9 at the top and sharp 11, they're going to trip.
Right.
And that is, again, which brings me to the point that chord tones are great. But what starts to happen with chord tones is that you develop such an angular sound where it's like, oh, here's a C major 7 and here's a C major 7. That's what the chord tone does.
Yeah.
But then you have these other notes in between, which come from the scale that you can gravitate towards. And if not play off of it, you can use it as a stepping tone to go into your chord tones, right?
Yeah.
So you don't have to limit yourself to say, oh, I see a C major 7. I'm going to play just nice old chord tones, because I think of it from this angle. Like when I practice like, let's say if I'm just working on a jazz blues, a 12-bar blues, I would probably practice at the very least 30 choruses, 30 loops of it. Because, of course, in reality, I'm not going to play that long. Nobody is, right? We'd probably play maybe 3 or 4 choruses and we're out. Especially if it's like a jam session, there's like 20 horn players and like 5 guitar players waiting to play. Like, you got to get on quick.
Right.
But when you practice, I believe in exhausting myself. I believe in just putting it all on the table, you know? So when I do that, 30 choruses, I realize, man, playing chord tones alone, like 4 choruses in, I'm like out of ideas already. Mm. Then I do only scales, I'm out of ideas in probably 5 or 6 choruses. And then I kind of merge them together. And then I mix and match more scales and lesser chord tones, or more chord tones and lesser scales. Mm. So I experimented a lot with that. And I found that when you know your scales better than your chord tones, I think it can work to an advantage, because you get comfortable, first of all, hitting notes that are not chord tones and chord tones, but not just in position. You're able to play it anywhere on the neck. Mm-hmm. Again, it brings me back to Alan, because Alan always talked about looking at his fretboard as a big X. So he sees the lowest note here. He's also looking at the highest note on the E string. Mm-hmm. That's how far the eyes go. So I think that is possible by practicing chord tones, but it usually comes from practicing scales.
Yeah.
So, a lot of people, they argue with me a lot of times about this, because it's funny, because I love playing jazz and jazz fusion. Mm-hmm. And I'm in New York out of all places, and I've already started arguing with a couple of cats about chord tones versus scales, because I'm like,
oh, wow.
I'm like, scales is where it's at if you want to be real, because from a scale you derive the 1-3-5.
Yeah.
If I give you a 1-3-5, I give you chord, That's just a major triad. That could come from at least three keys, different three scales.
Yeah.
So it gives me three different sounds altogether. So you can, in essence, by default, just have three options of scales over one chord.
Yeah.
So what would you rather have? One set of chord tones or three scales?
Yeah.
Added on. I think it speaks for itself in that sense, you know? So yeah. I've been teaching long enough as well to see the result, even in the slowest students I've had who might be slow to hear things.
Sure.
But after like a couple of years, their ears start to really make more sense of everything and they're able to play better too, you know? So it definitely works in my opinion and experience, but I guess not everyone is accepting of it.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I agree with how you approach it, because it's funny, because it's like the person that's arguing with you about scales, it's like we're saying the same thing. It's just coming from it's just in a different realm. And I think, you know, because I remember John McLaughlin, as he had a quote where he was like, learn all the scales. He's like, learn them all. You know, he was like, why would you not learn all the scales? You know, and and then thinking about, you know, some of our great musicians, I say like Pat Martino, for example, it's like you're not going to get those enclosures or chromaticism without knowing of the other notes of the scales. If you're just focused on the chord tones, you're not, you know, if you're trying to learn a piece from Pat Martino, you're not going to do it if you don't know the scales, you know. So I find before I ask you the next question, I find it interesting too, as far as like I kind of had the same notion as far as like the pentatonic scale, where I felt like there's a lot of YouTube videos out there like, get out of the box, get out of the benchtop box, try this. And I'm like, you can get out of the box, but there's a lot in that box. You know, like that's a framework for modes. It's a framework for triads, for diatonics. Like
really get the most out of the box first.
Exactly.
You know, so yeah, for sure.
But definitely agree with you on that. Tell me about, one thing that I found interesting is you traveling, you know, to vast areas and places in the world, being a session musician, you know, playing with folks in different countries and whatnot. I guess tell me about that experience as far as like being a session musician and then playing music. You're playing music from different cultures, so it's not just like, Or correct me if I'm wrong, because my mindset goes, you know, it's different when you're on tour and you're playing the same set of songs that you learned, say, back in, you know, one particular area, versus being a session musician, you're playing completely different music in a different country. You know what I mean? So it's like, tell me about that experience and how that could be approached, because I could see that being a completely different scenario that, I mean, it might help some session musicians kind of understand that mind state.
Yeah, so first things first, being a session musician can be tricky, because one of the primary driving factors of whether or not you'll work is just how versatile you are across the board, right? So in like 2010, I had moved to Malaysia, and prior to that, I was in India. In India, I was traveling with a gospel band. We were playing a lot of gospel. I was playing drums. So, but not like contemporary American gospel music, like ethnically driven Indian, South Indian style gospel music, which is so different. It grew so different, right? But I grew up playing a lot of contemporary American gospel. So even though I was a lot younger then, I kind of had this realization, like, you know, I have to learn to adapt to the situation, right? And sometimes there could be certain things, like maybe the keys player is probably not the tightest playing cat, so you have to kind of make up for these kind of things to be sure that you're all together. So after I moved to Malaysia, right, so I started playing a lot of pop gigs with one particular pop artist back this is a while ago. So simultaneously, I was playing a lot of jazz and jazz fusion with visiting musicians who would, you know, basically from a very practical and realistic standpoint, logistically, let's say, if I want to put together a tour right now, me to play my records, the likelihood of me taking my entire band on the road is very low, because you gotta, it's a lot of money. You gotta think of all those things, right? So one of the things I kind of picked up from living in Malaysia and working with foreigners a lot, different visiting cats, was that I learned to adapt to every situation. And sometimes I got called for certain gigs just because I can play fast. So there was so many instances where I would get called for specific things as opposed to just because, oh, there's nobody else, or like, yeah, he can kind of do the gig, right? Mm-hmm. So I basically developed a knack of being a chameleon of sorts. So coming back to one thing that you just said about, it's very different from being on tour.
Yeah.
My cat is making a wreck. Hold on a second.
No problem.
There she is. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you're absolutely right, because it takes something else to, let's say I'm here today and I'm going to go play with a couple of cats somewhere else. Yeah. But we are playing a bit of my music, which I already know, and some tunes of theirs. So not only do I have to adapt to the situation, but the repertoire changes. Even if it's one or two songs, something is changing. Mm-hmm. But when you're on the road playing a show, you're basically not playing 180 shows. You're playing one show 180 times.
Right.
So that's very different. And a lot of people get offended when I say this, but it's kind of the truth. And a lot of my good friends who are heavy in the touring circuit doing pop and those kind of shows, they would agree, like, yeah, it is true. So I think for me, the primary thing that helped develop the skill set that I developed was that, this is going to sound really bad, but if I play with the same people repeatedly, I get bored.
Yeah.
Right. So I love changing my environment. So even when I was living in Malaysia and I started my group, I started writing music to play along the lines of jazz and fusion. Every show, I tried to change at least one member out. I would try to rotate the person out. I got another keys player. I would get another guitar player. I would get a singer this time. And the previous gig, I didn't have a singer. So I was always changing things up because I like change. I welcome change. So I predominantly built my career, or started my career, a bit in India. And then I moved to Malaysia. I moved back to the Middle East. And within the Middle East, I switched countries again. And then finally, I moved to New York, right? Mm. So it's very different doing it this way, because I haven't toured around the world extensively, but I have lived in 5 very different places.
Yeah.
It's so different. Like what I do here, what I did in Dubai before I moved here, I was in Dubai. What I did in Dubai was so different compared to, say, New York, because here there's so much more happening, right? So I've been here for 5 months. I've played a couple of gigs. I traveled out a couple of times to do a few shows already. But I'm not as busy as I can possibly be. And part of that is because I still need to assimilate and kind of process how the city works. For instance, in Asia, a lot of cities, when there's a musician that's better than you, the typical thing is to shun them out. It's a very cultural bias that happens a lot in Asia. It happens a lot in India even. Like there have been so many incredible musicians that come out of that country, but they never get the opportunity to actually be out there. And so I think if my primary takeaway from the experience that I've had so far is that you need to be able to adapt, and you need to be able to do it quick as well. Right. So, and some really funky things could happen. Like, I did a 3-night show with the Supremes, in 2019. And then a few months later, I played with the Brand New Heavies, an acid jazz, funk band from the UK. With the Brand New Heavies, I was called on the day off.
Oh.
Because the bass player lost his passport. So he didn't make the flight. So they called me then and there. Mm. And I had to play 13 songs with a 1-hour sound check.
Oh my goodness.
Versus the Supremes, where it was a 3-night thing. It was a little last minute, but there were charts. Mm. So I could read my way through it. And then, of course, I had to bring more to it. But the point is, they are two very different situations. And then if you YouTube me or go to my Instagram, most of the times I'm playing over jazz standards. I'm shredding and shredding and shredding, right? So people develop this conception like, oh, that's all this guy does. Like, I'm sure he cannot sit in a band, in a groove. But I think in order to have all the chops, you need to have a sense of groove. That's, I think, a fundamental law for musicians, in my opinion. But yeah, like, traveling in different parts of the world, and I would say spending extended periods of time, and I'm not saying like you touch down, you play the next night and you're out the following morning. Not that, but you actually stick around, experience the culture of the place, experience how people conceive you as a musician or as an artist, what you do. Like, my bass solos here or my guitar solos here are not received the same way like where I come from, for instance, or where you go far east. Like, if you go down to Indonesia, it's very different. So it's like, it's very interesting how the levels of perception varies depend on where you are geographically. Obviously, I have to say this, and this I don't mean in any biased way, but the reception to good musicianship in America is very good, because I think music is such an integral part of the culture and history. So it is quite nice that you come across a layman who is able to appreciate a good show, you know? Whereas, like, where I was in Dubai, like, you could play a really out-of-tune blues guitar solo, just bad, and people would be like, wow, man, you were killing. So, you know, so there's very different variables in that sense, where now a guy who's sloppy is being told he's great. You come to America, you're not going to get a gig, let alone maybe a chance to play at an open mic. So it's like, it's so different. So that's why I'm able to appreciate my moving out here right now at my age. I just turned 30, so I'm like, I'm able to absorb and appreciate this a lot better and differently.
Wow.
Right? Because if I was younger, I don't know how I would have handled myself, because I was also a hothead. I had a lot of temper issues and a lot of things in the past that I had to really work on. So yeah, if not just musicianship, but even your character development, living in different places. Like, I've encouraged a few musicians here too. I've met, I'm like, hey, maybe move to the Middle East for like 6 months. Just try it out. You don't have to stay there permanently, but just to get a perspective on everything for yourself, basically, you know? Yeah. So it helps you develop yourself as a musician and as a person overall. That's my personal takeaway so far.
Wow. And then I guess just in addition to that, like, tell me about, like, as far as like the language barrier, like, did you feel that like being able to read the charts and the music, like, it was obviously that was kind of the main connection, but when you're speaking, when you're in different countries, you're, you know, you're trying to get a little acclimated with the culture, but then you have, you know, you have a whole other language you're trying to get accustomed to. I mean, how is that, you know, being a session player?
I mean, language barriers can happen pretty much anywhere. I did a session in Dubai once where the producer just couldn't speak a word of English and he was speaking in Arabic. Thankfully, I can understand just enough to kind of paint the picture of what he's trying to tell me. So I think when it comes to language barriers, generally, it is hard to get certain thoughts across or ideas across. Also, that's one other thing I'll definitely say I faced as a problem when I was like in Malaysia and that part of the world, is that when you're not local, and by that I mean when you're not from there, a citizen of the country, they are a lot more hostile towards you because they feel like it's their gig to hold, but you are there, a foreigner, and you have taken our work, you know?
Right.
So that also, I don't think that's language barrier, but that is actually a cultural barrier, because you develop a sense of entitlement that way. And that also directly ties in with language barrier, because a lot of the things I would say, let's say I would say something like, you know, your time is not good enough, but maybe work on it to tighten it up. Now, if somebody is not a native English speaker, and they had to translate it in their mother tongue to understand it, a lot of those words will get lost in translation. You know, I remember teaching this kid from Korea, who couldn't speak a word of English. So he had a Google translator and I had a Google translator on my end. So we were typing things out. And then I was trying to get him to even say the words in English just so that he knows what the word is going to sound like. But at some point, his face just kind of went like, he had this face like, wait, what the fuck are you saying, you know? Yeah. But then he took a moment to just actually try and understand what it actually meant. And then it's like, oh, okay. So it's not that I am shit, but I'm weak there. Mm-hmm. And that is a big difference, right? When you tell somebody, you're a little weak here versus you're quite shit there. So it's like,
right. Like, you should stop doing this.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you should just, music's not for you. Like, so generally, you know, depending on the environment of where you're going and working, people are bound to speak English by default at the very least. If not everybody, there's going to be at least one person. So usually you're okay. But of course, don't be surprised if there's just nothing going your way. So you almost always have to be prepared for just about anything in that regard. Yeah.
That's good advice. Really good advice. One of the last things I wanted to ask you, as far as just like your own music, as far as you just creating, like, do you find it being someone who's so involved with music from a teaching perspective, from a career perspective, like just like, you know, doing gigs and whatnot, and then you being able to make your own music, like, does it still come natural to you where you're like, I'm going to make a song versus like, you know, like if you're a film critic, you're like, I don't want to watch any more movies. You know?
Yes. That is so important. It's like, I saw this meme video going around on Instagram. It was so funny. It was just this guy with a very thick Indian accent saying, you know, like, when you're fucked in life, just stay fucked. Like, you don't try to unfuck yourself. Mm-hmm. And as funny as it was, I'm like, you know, sometimes, if your mind is not there, just don't push yourself.
Yeah.
You know? So I believe that sometimes, like, as a creative, like, I've put out two records. The last one I put out was February last year. Mm. So, and the way it kind of lined up is that February 2019, my first record, February 2021, the second. Naturally, my head's going February 2023, bro. Like, get your third album out there. But I haven't written a song the whole year or just sat down to actually write because I was busy with, you know, like packing up in Dubai and shipping my stuff here, my flights, visas, embassies, and just like I need to move here, right? So I've been caught up with that. So I still feel bad. I was actually just talking to my girlfriend about it, saying like, hey, you know, like, I want to get back into writing. But I still am not feeling that level of anxiety and that urge to want to sit and make time for it. Not that I don't have the time. I definitely do have quite a bit of time since I've moved because just getting acclimatized, new country, new people, right?
Yeah.
But I think what I would suggest to myself, even for that matter, is that an idea is an idea. So it doesn't have to be a full-fledged, oh my, like 5-minute masterpiece. Even a 5-second, just a 2-chord loop kind of thing you come up with, a nice groove, hold on to that, you know? Mm. So I would have these small ideas that I just throw on Logic and I'd be like, oh, okay. I don't know where to take it, but it's there. If at some point I feel like I can make something out of it, I'll come back to it and check it out. But I definitely don't force myself to write. In that sense, another thing I've been trying to experiment with is actually write without an instrument. So just either sheet music, or I have my iPad here. It's like a blank slate. I'm just trying to actually write at that point, literally, where I don't have an instrument to reference. Oh, I want to put this chord and your fingers go there.
Yeah. But
I'm trying to think, what happens if I don't have that? Am I really going to hear F sharp, major 7, sharp 11 in my head? Or am I not going to hear even a chord? Maybe it's just going to be one note, you know? It's very interesting because one band that has an immense influence on me, this again ties in with the Alan Holdsworth parallel, is Meshuggah. For any musician out there, regardless of what you play, what instrument and what style of music, Meshuggah is a must listen because they're the pioneers of their own sound and genre in the heavy metal world. A lot of bands today, like Animals as Leaders, you know, Tosin Abasi.
Yeah, yeah.
All these cats are heavily influenced by Meshuggah. Mm. When you listen to Meshuggah, their songs are like, there's probably like four notes in one tune. But the way they go back and forth and they combine it with a very serious groove, it's incredible. And then the guitar solos are really out of this world in the sense that they are not your conventional rock or metal solos. He's like playing like a horn player would, like a flugelhorn or a sax player would.
Oh, wow.
So a very different train of thought, right? So I was just the other day, I posted a lesson on my channel talking about one of the tunes a little bit. But I've just been on this binge and I managed to catch them here in New York in September. And my mind was just blown away watching the show because it was just such a... such a sonical and visual and auditory experience, you know? So I was watching a video of theirs, the guitar players, right? So they were talking about composition and the guy just asked them very silly, like, what makes you guys compose with just like four or five notes? Like, you guys play so minimal, the number of notes, but then what makes you compose that way? And then the guy's like, well, I could easily write some stuff. And he starts playing the very typical cliche metal rock stuff. The blues rock. He's like, but I'm going to be the millionth guy who's doing that. Like, right. There is really no point in me trying to assert dominance in something that's already been dominated. So they found that just really having a nice heavy ass groove with a guitar riff that supports the groove but doesn't take anything away works for them. So they in essence created that whole sound in the 90s when a lot of people were still fresh off of the 80s metal, you know, so there's a trickle effect of the thrash kind of metal. But then Meshuggah comes out playing something totally different and people are just like, what's going on? Was very ahead of his time in that sense, you know?
Yeah.
And then I started looking back. I imagine that's how it must have been when Charlie Parker came out, when Coltrane, or even players and composers like Wes Montgomery, Wayne Shorter. There's so many of these guys who wrote with like a slight twist to the way compositions typically work. And it was like very interesting for me to think about all these things. And that also brings me to another thing I just wanted to say before I go yapping away.
Sure, but
Pat Martino, he kind of broke out on the scene really early, right? When he was 13, he was playing with Jimmy Heath.
Yeah.
So Coltrane was still around, so they would catch Coltrane's gigs. And there's an interview of Martino with Christine McBride. And one of the questions McBride asked him was, hey, did you ever take lessons with Coltrane, you know? And of course, naturally, I think if any of us were alive at the time, if we take our current mindsets, we would want to sit and study with these people, right?
Of course.
But Martino said, no, never. I was just like, oh, okay. And then he goes on to say, he said, if you met the guy, you would know why going for a lesson is not going to get you anywhere. Because the guy was just that.
Yeah.
What he is what he played. And exactly. And he said he was surrounded by that. And then I started thinking, I'm like, you could study and do a lot of things, but ultimately your character is going to define everything. Right?
Yeah.
So I feel like this also is funny because when I was trying to kind of force myself to sit and write some ideas, I was regurgitating a lot of things I've already used. So, I'm just like, that's an idea. And then I'm like, wait a second. I think that's off of like the first record. And I'm just like, damn it. So, I think when I generally compose, I try to be less mission oriented now. So I'm not trying to put out the next record and be the next big thing. I just want to put ideas down as it comes. And funny enough, as I grow older, my ideas, as obscure as they are, they're also getting really simplified. So there's not too much going on, but there's also quite a bit going on in the way I hear certain things. So definitely, I don't want to be forceful about it. I just want it to happen naturally as best as it can.
Absolutely. I feel like sometimes as musicians, we tend to, I feel like sometimes in an earlier artistic stage, we tend to write for other people and then versus writing for ourselves, like writing music for us, like this is what I want to write versus this is what I think people will like, you know. I feel like there's always a struggle with that.
And one interesting thing is that That reminds me of a conversation I had with Suzy Green, who's one of the singers with the Supremes. Mm. So she and Stevie Wonder co-wrote Can't Help It for Michael Jackson. Mm. And it was funny because she was telling me through the process, like they're kind of, you know, Stevie's kind of putting on the chords and then she's thinking of the melody and they have the lyrics going on, but it's so enjoyable to listen to. But then she's like, but for some reason, if I tried to do that for myself, it just wouldn't work. So even that, I was thinking, like, when you see, you know, like Stevie wrote for MJ, or you would see certain people do these kind of things, while their signature might be there, like Can't Help It is one of those tunes which has a bit of the Stevie thing happening, a little bit,
yeah,
because he wrote it. But MJ definitely made it his own, and it definitely sounds like an MJ song in the sense of how he sang it and performed it.
Right.
But then I tried to imagine, how would Stevie sound like singing the same melody and lyrics? It would still sound great, but definitely different.
Mm.
So I think even that is a nice perspective to have. Like, what if you were to compose for a fellow artist or somebody you work with, yeah, or even somebody you admire, have them in mind and think, you know, like, how would I play to not maybe only appeal to them, but also have them play on my tune, you know, like those kind of things. So sometimes, like, there's one tune on my last record that in my head, I just thought I'm Alan Holdsworth. You know, that's all I was thinking about. But when the time came for me to track the guitar solo, I just could not for the life of me do it because I realized I'm not Alan Holdsworth at that point.
Sure.
So at that point, I changed gear and I'm like, yeah, let me bring myself back into the mix. But it's definitely an interesting angle to keep it fresh too.
Definitely. No, I agree. Yeah. I guess one of the last things before we close out, I always have this conversation with people about the Beatles as far as, like, I feel like they're better songwriters than they were musicians. And I always say, you know, you're a good songwriter when someone covers your music and it sounds better.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, absolutely. And it also goes to show the weight of the composition, you know, and how it's universally playable. Because, like, another, like, speaking of Beatles, another one of my favorite songwriters is Joni Mitchell. But Joni's music, I think only she can do it, though, when you look at it from that angle, right? Because I some of her tunes, especially the tunes she did in the 60s and then she kind of revamped it in like early 2000s, it's just like, wow, how could the same song be translated two ways by the same person? It's like, it's incredible.
Yeah.
And when you see somebody else try to do it, it's like, nah. So that's, like, for me, a good example of good songwriting, but also just the execution of it is just where it's supposed to be. Yeah,
absolutely. Well, Anthony, it's been a pleasure, man, having you on the show. I appreciate you speaking with me today.
And likewise, had a good time.
Awesome. Well, there you have it, folks. This is Jarrell from the 440 Guitar Podcast. We'll jam again soon and have a good day.